Hello, it's Wednesday, August 25th, 2021, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the studio in the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues, Kathy Kiley and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, Pfizer's first. The FDA gives full approval on the two-dose vaccine against COVID-19. We'll talk about the messaging and what this means for reaching the vaccine hesitant. The Kansas City Star readers might have noticed some big changes in their Sunday paper this past weekend. And
this is Jeopardy!
In the form of a question, who is going back to the drawing board? They're in search of a new host of the Daily Jeopardy program again. We'll talk about why and the role that journalists had in this new development. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to before our half hour is up today, but we're going to start with the latest developments in Afghanistan and the efforts to get journalists out of that country. Yesterday, the Taliban announced that Afghans would no longer be granted access to the Kabul airport with the hope of fleeing that country. Meanwhile, most major U.S. news outlets have successfully evacuated their staffs from that city, including Afghan freelancers and interpreters, with the help of the Qatari government. What do we know about how this was carried out?
Well, I think what a lot of people are doing is, and I think what you saw with the three big publishers, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and the New York Times, was a joint effort to both pressure our government and to make the necessary arrangements that they needed to do to get their folks out. And we've heard a lot of praise for the Qatari government from the publisher of the Washington Post, particularly. I'm also hearing that a number of private organizations, some of them press organizations, some of them others, are chartering flights to go into Kabul Airport and in a last-ditch effort to get hundreds and thousands of people out before the August 31st deadline. I think the big question now is going to be, will the people be able to get to the airport?
I think one of the keys here was, and I think this happened either late last week or early this week, when the Biden administration really ramped up getting airlines to go in and help evacuate people as quickly as possible. I mean, one of the things that was the biggest complaints when we talked about this last week was the fact that they just didn't have the capacity to be able to do the evacuation in a much more efficient and expedient way. And I think that's definitely ramped up within the last week.
Yeah, I think it's important. It's great news that those journalists got out, but it's important to remember that those are not the only journalists. The U.S. government, through VOA and our Radio Free Asia, there are hundreds of native journalists who are working there for U.S. outlets, and many of them are still there. So I think that's going to be the next big push.
And even the foreign outlets are having problems. I mean, the Australians are still having issues getting out. The Canadians are still having issues getting out. So, I mean, it's just this push to get as many of them out who are covering it for a whole host of media organizations around the world to get them out before that August 31st deadline, because we really don't know what's going to happen after August 31st. I mean, the Taliban is saying that They've changed their ways. They're going to be much more open. They're going to be much more diplomatic. They want to have economic ties with various countries. But there's a lot of hesitancy on the part of those who aren't quite sure this version of the Taliban is any different than the previous one.
Yeah, what happens once we reach that point? Next Wednesday, we could be sitting here wondering, what does news coverage look like coming out of that country after that August 31st deadline?
You know, I think Ernest is right. I think we are, I would not put a whole lot of faith and credence in what the Taliban 2.0 is saying, but I think what is going to have to happen is a lot of cross-border coverage, that you will see news organizations and reporters outside of Afghanistan working their sources inside of Afghanistan. It's not going to be easy, but I think in order to get, you'll see agencies like Radio Free Asia, like the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project, mm-hmm. which has a big footprint in Asia and is funded partly by our own State Department. I think you're going to see organizations like that trying to set up camp on the perimeter where it's safe for journalists or safer, and trying to use technology and sources to report on what's going on inside.
Could this also kind of take the form, as you're mentioning this, I'm thinking of Will Ripley, who was one of my classmates here when I was an undergraduate, who works for CNN. For a long time, he was CNN's North Korea reporter based in Tokyo, maybe doing some of that reporting from a nearby country that has safer relations.
Yeah, I think that's what's going to happen. My fear is that we're going to see less and less coverage of Afghanistan as we move further and further away from the U.S. involvement in that. And not just by U.S. news organizations, but maybe worldwide news organizations, because if we're looking at the Taliban in the way in which they were previously, they're going to clamp down on any kind of information getting out. And as you, and Kathy, you know this just as much as I do, when you have that kind of a sort of shell over news coming in and out, it becomes less and less of a story.
It's harder to cover, and people are going to be less willing to make that kind of investment. I think that's true. And I think there's going to be kind of almost a turning away. I mean, we talked about this last week, but I think what makes this particularly hard and different from Vietnam is that we are seeing the cries for help on live television, and we're not going to be able to save all of those people. And it's going to be hard for people to look at Afghanistan for a while.
Okay. There have been a lot of headlines this week in the other big breaking news story in our nation's fight against the COVID-19 virus. The first and arguably the biggest of those headlines, Pfizer winning approval, the full-on approval from the FDA for the vaccine. And as we are returning to classes here at Mizzou, as the public schools have returned, this is really big news as we look at ways that perhaps we can reach the vaccine hesitant, the ones that data show us are the people who were waiting for that full approval, wanting to see that the vaccine was going to be safe, and studies prove that.
Yeah, and it's already happening. I mean, just before we begin taping the show today, Delta announced that all of its employees have to be vaccinated. This is where you're going to have this pushback. It's going to come from the private sector. It's going to come from those companies and organizations that say, look, if you're going to work for us, if you're going to continue to be employed by us or connected to us in any way, you're going to have to be vaccinated. And the vaccine is available. Now that it has full approval, doctors can prescribe it. And the other thing is that along with Delta, didn't just say you're going to have the vaccination. If you choose not to have the vaccination, then there's going to be a surcharge on the insurance that we provide you as employees.
Because we're not going to pick up the tab for your insurance when you end up with a $20,000 hospital bill.
And that's what's going to push it, is the fact that now it's going to cost. And it's going to cost the individual, and not just, you can just go to the hospital, go to the emergency room, and they take care of you. That's not going to be the case anymore. What's going to happen is the insurance companies and the employers who are paying for that insurance are going to say, no, we're going to charge you for this expensive health care that you're getting because you didn't want to take the vaccination.
One of the other things you mentioned about private industry beginning to mandate it. One of the stories I saw very late last night before I went to bed, ironically, as I was reading about the lawsuit from the Missouri Attorney General against the Columbia Public Schools, is that there's a school district in the St. Louis area that is now going to require the vaccine for students who are 12 and above for the, or 16 and above to require, recommend for 12 and above. And that's kind of another storyline we're going to start to see more and more often, not only the added requirements, but some of that legal pushback as well.
And I think that's what it's going to take. I thought you were being overly nice, actually, when you talked about the vaccine hesitant. I think what Ernest said is really a description of what the approval, the full approval of Pfizer green lights employers, green lights insurance companies who have been just waiting for this to say, no excuses now. Because I think for a long time people were saying, oh, I'm not going to do it until it gets full approval. If it's only under emergency approval, I'm not going to do it. That is now a green light for employers. And I think what a lot of people in the society are saying is no more free riders. You know, all of these people over here went and got the vaccine so that we could get back to normal. And there are other people who are coming into our spaces spreading infection and or costing us money. I mean, I have a former classmate, a college classmate, who is a doctor in Philadelphia, and some of the COVID patients, their lungs are so badly damaged that the only hope for them is a lung transplant. Think about the cost of that. So I think, you know, we're just going to see a lot more.
Or if there's one person in that situation, and if there are many others who have contracted COVID who long-term could require that level of care as well, and what that does to transplant lists and the availability of organs.
Yeah, and going back to what you were talking about with the Attorney General filing the lawsuit against Columbia Public Schools, I mean, now that you have this full authorization, that sort of hampers these sort of laws that have come out about mask mandates and that sort of thing, because they're saying, look, you know, we have a vaccine. We have a way to actually help people to be able to fight this.
Vaccine that has been studied.
Absolutely.
And proven to be effective and safe. And I think that could end up being one of the storylines we end up covering short-term, mid-term, long-term, is how some of these cases could end up going as far as the Supreme Court.
No, absolutely.
Well, and the initial decision from the Supreme Court was not good.
No, not for Eric Schmidt.
And here's the other thing. Yeah. So school districts and universities can do this. Okay, we won't have a mask mandate. We'll have a vaccine mandate. You know,
I don't mean to chuckle again on this, but you're right. Like you didn't like it when we said that your curfew was 11. Fine, now your curfew's 9.
yeah. I mean, so that's the other side to that, because a lot of these laws aren't tied to the vaccine. They're tied to mandates around mask and social distancing and that sort of thing. So the school districts can just say, you know what? Vaccine for everybody.
So the FDA's communications department had a lot of work to do this week, right? They put out this information about the vaccine being safe. They announced the full authorization. They made sure that was shared widely. And at the same time, they were putting together this meme that is now all over social media that says, you are not a horse, you are not a cow. Because it's having to counteract this messaging coming primarily from Fox News, telling people to take, Ernest is making the face before I can even get it out, telling people to take this drug that they're picking up at feed supply stores that is meant to deworm horses and cows, and that's going to be an effective COVID treatment. It's like gargling bleach all over.
I don't know. Where is this coming from? I read the story and I'm sitting there.
It's coming from Fox News.
We are a year and a half or more into this, and you still have these wild, I don't even, you know where this is coming from. It's like, try this instead of something that's been tested over and over and over again by the best scientists in the world.
And by the way, many, many of your fellow citizens have taken, and they're still living to tell the tale.
But you're going to take something that we give to horses and cows as opposed to something
to deworm them.
To deworm them. Okay. As opposed to taking something that millions of people have taken
worldwide and
it's proved effectively. Mm-hmm. And people are like, okay, I'll do this instead of that. I'm sorry.
Well, I keep wanting to say I need to get a book about the Know Nothing movement and find out how that ended.
Yeah.
But one of my friends said maybe it didn't end, and they're like cicadas. They're coming back.
And so here's the irony of this, right? So this messaging about the Ivectin is coming out from Fox News primarily, at the same time that the Dow Jones owned newsrooms, so we're talking about the New York Post, we're talking about the Wall Street Journal, we're talking about Fox News, has instituted a mask mandate within their newsrooms. And you must now be wearing a mask if you get up from your desk. It seems like there's a little bit of mixed messaging going on.
Well, but
there.
this has always been Murdoch. When it comes to anything that's connected to Fox and Fox News, there's one way of doing things. But if it's connected to the Wall Street Journal or Dow Jones, there's a whole nother area there. So, you know, that's...
But it's an organization, what you're talking about, Amy, is an organization that has contempt for its readers and its viewers. I mean, what you do for yourself isn't good enough for your readers and viewers. You're not going to recommend that they do the same thing that you're doing.
Well, some readers are viewers.
So you're saying there's a distinction. That's true. And so I think, you know, and it's a very classist kind of argument. And so I think, and I think this gets to a philosophy of news coverage that I would hope we're coming to embrace, which is that we journalists are part of our communities. And we need to let our communities know that we stand with them and we're rooting for them to flourish and succeed. And that's not happening with these Fox outlets or the Murdoch outlets.
Okay, so let's bring it a little bit closer back to home. If you had picked up a copy of the Kansas City Star this weekend, you probably noticed some changes. Maybe it was a bit thicker. Digital readers might have noticed, as I did Sunday morning, it was hard to find anything on that homepage that wasn't Kansas City Chiefs coverage. Kathy, executive editor Mike Fannin announced that there were going to be some changes, and those were going to debut this weekend. Tell us about what went on there.
Well, this is really an interesting story because it appears to be a story of a hedge fund with a heart. The Kansas City Star is part was part of the McClatchy chain, and it's still part of that same chain of newspapers, but they are now owned by Chatham, which is a hedge fund. And we've talked a lot on this program about how hedge funds have tended to gut news organizations. So far, it looks like Chatham has decided to invest in news. And there are a lot of things going on, thicker newspapers, bigger news hole. They're doing some interesting things with their e-editions. One of the most interesting to me, they're publishing an early morning e-edition. So it's the same news that would be on the internet, but it's more of a newspaper-like feel for readers, and you get a sense a chance to say, I finished the paper today because
so is that in the PDF version that you would kind of download from the upper right corner of
right,
the website?
Right, it's the upper left corner
left
now.
Corner.
And it's a,
okay.
But it's a much more interactive and a much more sophisticated sense. But they're
so this
doing
is separate from the regular homepage.
You access
it from the homepage, but it's a different product, if
a different
you will,
feel,
still
very
online.
Different feel.
Okay.
Very much much more like the traditional newspaper pagination and layout and all of that, and a sense of I finished. Mm-hmm. You can get to the end, which a lot of people think is psychologically important to readers.
Okay.
So they're doing that one of them, and in addition, they're doing an early morning one which fronts the sports teams, and so it's late sports scores, but they're going to have an afternoon edition. How many people remember afternoon newspaper?
I worked for an afternoon newspaper.
So did I.
I did at one
we're dating
point
ourselves
and,
big time.
Yes, we are.
And the Columbia Daily Tribune was an afternoon newspaper until, what, about 5-6 years ago? Help me with the math. Since COVID.
About 8 to 10 years
ago. Okay.
So all things new or old again, or old or new again. And but the big headline is they are hiring 11 investigative reporters.
Wow.
That is a huge investment in local news, and they're expanding their news hole in print. So I think it's interesting to see that a hedge fund, which is supposed to be smart money, has come in and said, gee, maybe if we give people a better product instead of a lesser product, they'll start buying again.
And so
I think it's going to be an interesting experiment.
These 11 people... you say investigative, so they'll be working on projects, not so much daily news coverage.
You know, unclear.
Sounds more enterprise.
Unclear, but
okay.
I think the idea is enterprise news.
Okay.
As it might be, as you and I know, and we all know, an investigation doesn't have to be a 6 month or a year long project. And I would imagine they'll try to syncopate things so it's a mix. But and the reporters are yet to be hired, but they've announced that that's what they plan to do. So it's a real turn, and I think a really hopeful sign. Let's hope they succeed.
I think the key here. What's your thought on the strategy?
Well, I think the key here is going to be how long are they going to stick with this investment? Because I mean, Kathy, you and I have been in watching this for a long time, and generally, what will happen is that they'll put these initiatives in place, and if they don't see some return on investment in a quarter or two quarters or three quarters, then all of a sudden you start to see the investment sort of gets pulled back and they sort of go back to what they've been doing. I would hope, and I really do hope in this case, that they will stick with this investment long enough to see whether or not it's going to actually work and whether or not there's going to be some sort of change in that. Because really, people have been in this sort of environment of less and less and less and less for so long, it's going to take a while for them to be able to actually engage in this and actually understand and embrace what this is.
It takes a long time to build a new habit.
It does. Yeah. And we talk about that too with things we do here, that you're going to need maybe even as long as 2 or 3 or 4 years to really see what the impact is. How long, Ernest, do you think you have to give this before you can say it either worked or it didn't?
I don't know. I'm thinking you're going to have to at least give it 3 years.
Yeah.
I think you're going to have to give it at least 3 years, maybe even 4, because Kathy's right. I mean, you know, habits are hard to break, and people are in the habit now of getting their news in a different way. And the other thing is that if you're going to do investigations, those investigations are going to have to be things that people care about, things that impact their lives on a daily basis. So, I mean, I'm not saying gone are the days of doing the big exposés and that sort of thing, but there are investigations out there that can actually be done that answers the questions, tell people why certain things are happening, as opposed to just, I'm telling you what's happening and that, you know, this person lied here or this person did something shady here.
Yeah, they don't all have to be Watergate.
You know what I haven't gotten to say to Ernest in a while? You mean they can bring context?
They
can bring in the context. So while we're bringing it closer to home, let's get even closer to home, where Joseph Elledge is expected to go on trial on November 1st for the murder of his wife, Mengxi Zhi. We learned this week that among those the prosecution wants to hear from, former KRCG reporter Gladys Batista. It all dates back to this report she filed on October 15th, 2019.
Investigators say Elledge noticed his wife missing the morning of October 9th. According to a news release, he reported her missing later that evening around 5:45.
You reported her missing at 5:45. Any reason why, from when you realized that she was gone till 5:45, that you called?
I really didn't know where she could have gone. She was supposed to meet somebody in the morning, and I didn't know who else she was going to meet, what else she was going to do. It was really weird that she didn't take her phone and everything like that.
He says they had been going through a tough time.
We were kind of growing distant in the past few months. Sometimes she didn't talk to me a lot about what was going on in her life. I know she was talking to somebody else on the side, and I didn't know that until after she had left.
So that clip came from the edited piece that ran on KRCG that's on its website now. And you can watch the full 9-minute and 15-second interview that Batista did with Joseph Elledge. And prosecutors are saying there's evidence within that interview and they want to know more.
Yeah, this is not unusual for prosecutors to do this. What's unusual to me is that they put the 9 minutes up for people to actually
see. Well, and that's KRCG
because,
that's doing
right,
that.
Right, that's what I know.
Right. That's not the prosecution. That's not anybody else.
Yeah, but usually news organizations don't do that. They'll give you the edited version, but they're not going to give you everything. And so what the prosecutors are probably saying is that, okay, there's probably more there than the 9:30 that you put out there. We want to know what was actually said in just the conversation between Batista and Elledge prior to and even after that 9 minutes and 30 seconds.
So help me out here on this one, Ernest. I was trying to think again. I've lived here 11 years. Kathy, you've been here 3,
mm-hmm.
right?
Three.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You're here longer than that. Can you remember the last time there was a heater case like this in Columbia or in Boone County, mid-Missouri, that would have had a reporter subpoenaed to go into court? Because I think that's the part that makes people think that this is unusual, because it doesn't happen that often here.
Right. The only case I could think of is back when I was an editor at the Missourian, back in the 90s, was the Johnson case, where the three people were killed at the Casey's store out east of town. And I think that case is back in the news now because he's coming up for death penalty, and there's there are issues involving that. But that would have been the case for me that I would think that would have gotten this kind of publicity that you're seeing with the Elledge case right now.
Yeah, I'll be surprised if the prosecutors win, but they might. I mean, this has become a much more hostile environment for reporters. And of course, people might say, why should the press fight this? Well, it makes it harder to do interviews. It makes it harder to get people to talk to you if you then become part of the prosecution. So I think I would hope that the news organizations will fight it. There are exceptions, and you know, a judge may decide this fits it for cases where a crime has been committed to press shield. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah,
and there's no real press shield, but
right. No, absolutely. I mean, I think you're right. It does make it difficult. I mean, I've had a lot of friends in the business who have been called by prosecutors to do this, and oftentimes what will happen is that the prosecutor will ask them outside of the jury, outside of the court, is there something here that might be evidence that we could use, and sometimes, most times, journalists will say, no, what you see is what you get, and that's all you're going to get. And then the lawyers get involved. And
that's a great point, Ernest, because we report what we know.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, we usually, unless somebody has asked us to keep a confidence, we don't not report things. And when we don't not report things, we usually tell people we're not reporting things. So we're pretty transparent. So I think this might be more of a grandstand.
Yeah.
The prosecutor saying, I'm turning over every stone.
Right.
Okay, so you remember last week I played this clip?
Jeopardy is an incredibly important American institution. It's about making people that are smart the most important people in the room.
So that guy is Mike Richards, the executive producer of Jeopardy, and he had been the person tapped to take over as the host of the syndicated daily program. Not anymore. Mayim Bialik will host the next 3 weeks while Sony Pictures goes back to the drawing board. This is about a record of derogatory remarks he made about women and about Jewish people. And it was really about the journalists who dug through his record that...
Well, yeah, I mean, they dug through the records. It was always there. I mean, the problem, and we talked about this last week, the problem with him being named host was that he named himself, you know, all this so-called vetting that they did was not vetting, because if they had vetted it, they'd have found all of this. It was right there, and they probably would have made another decision.
But he was running the search.
Yeah.
So he pulled a Cheney, and now he had to pull a Cuomo.
That's right.
Okay, so... who do they go back to now?
They have such great candidates.
They have great candidates.
We talked about last week.
Last week the door wasn't open
to them. I'm still a LeVar Burton fan.
Me too.
I am. I mean, that would be the guy I would pick. But that's me.
Yes, and for because he's delightful. And as you were saying, Amy, I can't remember if you said it on the air or off. He appeals across generations.
He does.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Finally, before we go. You hear that music? Yep, that's the Rolling Stones' Start Me Up. And after Keith Richards' hard guitar riff came Charlie Watts on drums. Instead of ending our program with our regular theme music today, we're going to leave you with this as we remember Watts, who died yesterday at the age of 80, surrounded by family in a London hospital. We are out of time for today, so I'd like to thank you for spending this time with us. Urge you to take a look at our links blog on the KBIA.org website. We're under the Programs and Podcasts tab. Our thanks to RJ Ice, Travis McMillan for directing today's show, Aaron Hay for handling the audio, and Tim Pilcher for composing that theme music you heard at the beginning of the show. I'm Amy Simons. We'll see you next week.